Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the battle for Aleppo in Syria that the Assad regime has oddly characterized as the mother of all battles. A former member of the State Department's policy planning staff on the Middle East, Henri Barki, joins us to discuss the increasing desperation and destructiveness of the regime and the continuing disarray amongst the opposition. Then we'll examine Mitt Romney's visit to Israel, where he has met with his close friend, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and we'll meet later with Sheldon Adelson and others of his major donors for a fundraiser at the King David Hotel on Monday. The former director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum, MJ Rosenberg, joins us to discuss the differences between Obama's unshakable support for Israel and Romney's unconditional support for Israel. Then finally, Aaron David Miller joins us. He is a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and has been a Middle East advisor to six secretaries of state. His latest book is Can America Have Another Great President? And he has an article at CNN, Will Israel Trip Help Romney? That offers an historical perspective on the relationship of past U.S. presidents with Israeli leaders. And joining us now is Henri Barki. He's a professor of international relations at La Jolla University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored and co-authored and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Responses to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barki.
Thank you.
And what did
By the way, it's Lehigh and not Lehigh.
Oh, sorry, Lehigh. Okay. Well, it's written in the French way. What can I say?
That's right.
What did you make of the regime's newspaper banner headline that the battle for Aleppo is the mother of all battles? Hadn't they heard of how Saddam Hussein somewhat devalued that phrase?
Well, look, it's sad. I mean, first of all, the fact that they're not aware of essentially what happened to Saddam Hussein or how Saddam used that phrase and how that phrase became essentially a joke. But there are many other things in which the Assad regime reminds you of Saddam Hussein's last days, when you have basically a denial of what is going on in their own country, thinking that there is, you know, it's only a few pockets of resistance, few pockets of terrorists. You remember that the famous information minister of Saddam Hussein was basically saying Baghdad was fine when American tanks were essentially rolling behind him on television. But, you know, Syria, the regime is not about to fall yet. I mean, that's not, yes, this is a big battle in Aleppo. The insurgents are doing much better, I think, than people expected. But in the end, the firepower and the capabilities of the Syrian military are still, and the willingness to kill on the part of the Syrians is much, much higher, and it is possible that, you know, they will reoccupy parts of Aleppo that are under control of the insurgents. But on the other hand, the regime is finished. I mean, every day that goes by is another nail in Assad's coffin. A government cannot be bombing its own cities, bombing its own towns, trying to invade its own cities and have any semblance of normalcy or state power. I mean, this is a regime that is fighting for its life and is trying to decide in the process how to probably extricate the leadership and find a solution to their families, to the people close to them, to the Alawite community. It's macabre, unfortunately.
Well, in terms of asylum, the Russian foreign minister got very testy when reporters asked him about reports that the Russians had offered Assad asylum. And the Russians, of course, are pretty surly about this whole situation. I guess they see the writing on the wall, and I imagine that when Assad falls, they're not going to be particularly welcome in that country.
Well, look, we don't know where Assad is going to end up. I mean, I don't see him having many options. I mean, Iran and Russia are the only two. I don't think the Chinese will want him. So, unless he wants to go to North Korea. But the truth is, he also has to think about a place that will not give him up, let's say, 5 or 6 years later, because there will be huge numbers of lawsuits against him. There will be international criminal court proceedings. I mean, the world is going to become too small for Assad, and he needs to go to some place where he can be sure that he's not going to be extradited.
Well, he's already destroyed the city. You're talking. This is the part that's bizarre, the extent to which he's prepared to destroy his own country to save his own hide. Homs is finished, isn't it? And Aleppo could well be destroyed.
Well, look, Aleppo is a very large city, so I suspect neighborhoods will be completely destroyed. I don't think the whole city will be destroyed. Look, this is a fight on the part of Assad and the Alawites in Syria for their very survival. I mean, they don't see a way out. The other thing that we have to understand here is that Assad was never a very smart leader. I mean, Assad is not a great visionary, a great leader, or even a smart person. So I don't think he sees his way out of this. I don't think he thinks that the end may be near. I mean, he may delude himself into thinking that he will survive. And for some people around him, and for the Alawite community, it's a do or die thing, because they have polarized the situation so much that the Alawites are terrified that in the event insurgents win, there's going to be a bloodbath. And it's not an unrealistic fear. It's a fear that the Assad regime has encouraged in order to stiffen up resistance. But what we do see, and what we will see eventually, is that this government in Syria is going to start running out of ammunition, is going to start running out of some basics like gasoline, and it's going to be very hard to maintain military operations. Already, we're talking about Aleppo, but the one thing we should remember is that large swathes of the countryside are not under his control. So he's now fighting in the cities, but he has already conceded large chunks of the territory. And there's no happy ending to this, unfortunately.
Again, I'm speaking with Henri Barki. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University, and he served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East and the Eastern Mediterranean and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. And he's authored and co-authored and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. Just turning to Turkey and the Kurds, the opposition, the Syrian opposition, had a meeting in Cairo a couple of weeks ago to try and agree on strategy, etc., and I guess the post-Assad situation. But this meeting, and I spoke to one of the English language spokesperson for the local coordinating committees from Cairo at the time of the meeting. Apparently this, she didn't tell me this, but apparently in this meeting, scuffles and fistfights broke out, and the Syrian Kurdish group walked out, visibly demonstrating their opposition, opposition's disarray. What's going on with the Kurdish sect? Why did they walk out, and what's their future role in this? Because the Turkish government has warned about interference by the PKK.
Well, the situation in the north of Syria and the heavily Kurdish regions is actually quite murky. But here is the issue. For the Kurds, what they want from the main opposition groups is some kind of guarantee that they will get their national rights recognized. You have to understand that the Kurds in Syria were terribly mistreated, were kicked out of citizenship. They were not allowed, those who were kicked out of citizenship were not allowed to go to schools, avail themselves of medical facilities. This was really a very terrible situation. So what they, for the Kurds now, it's an opportunity. They set out the beginning of the insurrection, and now that that they think that they are a critical player, because when you look at the layout of the land in Syria with the Christians, the Alawites, and the Sunnis, the Kurds, because of their geographical position and also because if they can come up with a coherent and a unified position, they can be a major swing player. The Kurds are also, one thing that people don't know is that they always we always focus on northern Syria, but there are also very significant Kurdish neighborhoods in Damascus that are critical to the control of Damascus. So the Kurds can play a very, shall we say, a critical role, but they want, and this is their moment, and they want something akin to not autonomy, but certainly recognition of separate rights. They don't want Syria to be become an Arab country. They want to be recognized as that Syria is multi-ethnic, and so they're driving a hard bargain. But in the north, because the Syrian troops have pulled out, the Kurds now control large chunks of territory, including some maybe some border crossings. But the Kurds themselves are not unified. And the Kurdish leader in Iraq has been trying to unify them, because you have a major division between those who are close to the Turkish Kurdish group, the PKK, and those that are more moderate. But at the moment, those affiliated with the Turkish insurgent group, the PKK, have the upper hand, because they are the ones who are armed, they are the ones who are trained, they are the ones who have the militia. I suspect this will change with time, but what we will see a great deal of is Masoud Barzani, the president of the Kurdistan regional government in Iraq, trying to exert influence over the Syrian Kurds in order to A, not alienate the Turks, and B, come up with a coherent position in order to be able to extract concessions from the opposition in Syria. Look, this is an ongoing development, and we will hear a lot about it. Nothing is clear. The Turks, on the one hand, are anxious that pro-PKK insurgents in Syria have the upper hand, but I think they also understand that the Syrian Kurds do not have the muscle and the wherewithal to establish an autonomous and independent state in northern Iraq, and they also trust Barzani to run a lot of interference for them. It's murky, it's complicated, but we are in a period of civil war in a very critical country in the Middle East. You have a lot of foreign interests involved in here. You have lots of foreigners fighting now, including from Pakistan and Libya and Chechnya and God knows where else. Even if Assad were to leave tomorrow, this is going to be a very confusing, chaotic, unsettled, and unstable part of the world for a very, very, very long time. You know, for 40 years, the Assad regime, father and son, essentially held the Middle East hostage. And the irony is that even at the end of their reign, even if they were to leave, their long shadow will continue to have an impact on the Middle East. We're in for a very difficult period in this region. And what happens in Syria will affect Iraq, will affect Lebanon. Will force a change in Iranian policies. Nobody can tell you what's going to happen. I think anybody who knows what's going to happen is probably deluded.
And I guess you have to add to that, Henri Barkey, the uncertainty about the fate of the chemical weapons arsenal, which the Syrians recently acknowledged. Israel, of course, fears that ending up in Hezbollah's hands. And with the aggressive talk going on now with Romney's trip to Jerusalem, is pretty bizarre that at a moment where Iran appears to be losing its major ally, it would seem to be the last moment that you'd want to provoke any kind of a strike on Iran, which would have result in a massive retaliation by Hezbollah, who could rain rockets down on Israel. I don't get it.
Well, look, we are in the United States in this period called the silly season. I mean, this is our election period. You know, everything that is irrational and illogical gets hyped up and gets. Romney is trying to score points against the administration, but that doesn't mean one way or the other that the Israelis are going to hit Iran now. As you said, I mean, when you look at it from an Israeli perspective, I mean, what is happening in Syria is such a big game changer. It's going to undermine Iran's strategic position so much. Now, it may encourage the Iranians even more to go towards the bomb, because now they will find themselves so much more isolated with Assad gone. So that's another issue. But from a purely strategic perspective, Hezbollah is on the defensive. In Lebanon, people are very angry at Hezbollah for siding with Assad. They were already angry at the way Hezbollah was throwing its weight around. And once Assad falls, or Assad, whether he's already fallen for all intents and purposes, he's not going to think about Lebanon at this stage. When you think of it from this perspective, you have a very, very weakened Hezbollah. You have an Iran that is desperate to hold on to Assad, but he's going to lose that. So in many ways, the strategic picture will have changed radically in favor of Israel. So I think that is another reason why the Israelis are not going to attack. But part of the hardline talk is a semi-bluff, in the sense that the Israelis have actually, surprisingly, have played this actually not badly, in the sense that they've played the good cop, bad cop with the Americans. I mean, the Americans saying, oh, don't attack, and Israel saying, oh, we're going to attack. But that has put pressure on the international system to push the Iranians. And from that perspective, the administration has been actually very successful. I don't know if the administration would have been successful on its Iran policy in terms of pushing Iran if it wasn't for the fact that it could use the threat of Israeli intervention as a means of mobilizing international support. So, one day when this is going to be written, the history of this period is going to be written, we may actually find out that it was actually a very different history than what we think is happening at any point in time. That's my hunch, but I don't know this obviously for a fact. And Romney's visit to Israel and the bellicose statements on Iran coming out from that visit actually are part of the same pas de deux, if you want.
Kabuki, I guess.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Henri Barkey.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Henri Barkey. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He's authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Responses to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. We're going to take a brief station break and be back to discussing the difference between Obama's unshakable support for Israel and Romney's unconditional support for Israel.